Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, a series of stories about race. Teton County finds a solution to a problem that they did not know existed until the pandemic hit.
The immigrants are in a disadvantage because, I don't know if that's the word, there is the language barrier.
The University of Wyoming wants to be more diverse, but ongoing racism makes that hard.
A lot of folks equate us with places in the South and white supremacist places.
And there were once multiple Chinatowns in Wyoming, but today they are buried underground along with much of the history of Chinese heritage in the state.
It's good to learn our history and so that we don't forget about the lessons of the past.
Join us for these stories and much more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Last summer, as we were all taking in the dialogue about racial injustice, our newsroom discussed the need to try and report on more of these types of stories. Today, we dip our toe into the water to bring you a handful of topics we hope you will find interesting. Savannah Marr has done a great job bringing you stories from the Wind River Reservation, and we will now be asking all of our reporters to find stories about racial disparities and inequality across the state. We will also be trying hard to get new voices into our stories. You can help with this effort by suggesting topics we should look into and people we should talk to. You can send those suggestions to us through our website. We hope this will lead to some new stories for us to share and enhance our storytelling. Now on with the program. Let's start with some history. When you think of pioneers, you might imagine Little House on the Prairie or the Oregon Trail game many played in the 90s. One thing these popular depictions of pioneers have in common is that they're white, but pioneers weren't all white. And historians argue it's important to set the record straight. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones explains.
So the directions said to turn left in Henry, Nebraska, which is just a mile.
I'm driving down a lonely country road. It's August, late in the day. Faraway wildfire smoke tinges everything hazy, makes the sun seem closer to setting than it is. There are sunflowers everywhere. I'm looking for a cemetery.
And I'm driving back to see if I missed it somewhere.
The cemetery is the last remnants of an old community that used to be here, northeast of Torrington, just shy of Nebraska. But I can't find it anywhere, just these bucolic fields fecund with corn. I turn around. And it's right there.
The Sheep Creek Cemetery. Inside the fence is the white people, the white, I guess, settlers or whoever that are buried here. And then outside of the fence are black settlers.
Those graves outside the fence are all that remains of Empire, Wyoming.
The town of Empire, or let's start over right there, because it was never really a town.
That's Todd Gunther. He's an anthropologist and historian at Central Wyoming College.
The community of Empire had its origins in 1908 when several families of black immigrants from Nebraska moved up into the Sheep Creek Valley and claimed homesteads and started farming and ranching in that area right on the Nebraska-Wyoming border.
These homesteaders were prosperous in Nebraska. They were descended from slaves, and their parents and grandparents had achieved an American dream. They'd gone from being owned to owning land. But now, in 1908, they were running out of farmland in Nebraska. And historian Jake Freefeld, who specializes in homesteaders, he says one of the families didn't feel super welcome in Nebraska.
The Spies family were classically trained musicians. The children would travel and put on concerts. They show up to give a concert one night, and the mostly white audience, or all white audience, is upset that it's not a minstrel show.
So they set up farms over the border in Wyoming. But man, farming was hard there. Dry, high altitude, and hostile neighbors.
Right from the earliest days, there were racial tensions. And whenever something would disappear, somebody would misplace an item or lose an item, the black families would be accused right away of stealing.
There were threats of violence, of white mobs coming for black people, for their families. And then in 1913, something terrible happened. Baseman Taylor was an Empire homesteader who sold his farm equipment and went to work in a Torrington restaurant, and he suffered from mental illness.
At some point, his family became concerned that he was a danger to himself. He had been suffering from what was probably depression and wanted him put in a hospital, I believe for that time it was called, for the mentally insane. They get the Goshen County Sheriff to come get him. He is beaten, and then he dies in the custody and is killed by the Goshen County Sheriff.
Baseman hadn't committed any crime or violence. This was a lynching. Between 1904 and 1920, at least 5 black men were lynched in Wyoming. That means that in those years, Wyoming had the number one lynching rate in the country.
So I'm not talking about like the law and order lynchings in Laramie in the 1860s or 70s. We're talking about racially motivated lynchings, the murder at the hands of a mob.
Soon after Baseman Taylor's murder, Empire dissolved. One or two at a time, people left. At its height, Empire was a collection of 65 black-owned farms. But by 1930, only 4 people were left, and the Dust Bowl quickly swept those 4 away. For years, most people in Wyoming didn't know that Empire existed. And while I've been working on this story, most Wyomingites I've spoken to still don't. But a couple years ago, the Wyoming State Museum sponsored a traveling exhibit about Empire. And there's a new Empire historical marker now at a rest stop on I-25 near Wheatland. The marker was just erected this year. Carla Slocum is a sociologist who studies black towns. She says stories of black people's impact on American history have been erased.
You know, if we're going to tell the American story and if we're going to tell American history, we need to have it complete. And there are so many silences around the black presence that this black town story is one of those parts that helps add to and round out the American story.
Back at the cemetery, I can just find 2 Empire graves. That is, graves outside the fence where black people were allowed to be buried. The 2 spread far apart, like the living were making room for generations to come. Like, there would be other families, new families, crowding in between. But there's only these 2 graves, far apart from one another, in a cornfield. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Erin Jones.
Staying on the topic of history, there were once multiple Chinatowns in the state, and a significant local population contributing to the Transcontinental Railroad, ranching, and entrepreneurship. But that history has been largely erased, Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
The wind is roaring at an archaeological dig site outside the 200-person town of Fort Bridger. The historic site is remembered as a supply shop and a military outpost. It was also the first place where Chinese immigrants were recorded in Wyoming back in 1857.
The evidence of the Chinese at this locality were a few ceramics, Chinese coins, the census records.
Dudley Gardner is a historian and archaeologist. He's been leading a dig here for nearly 40 years. The excavation is a big rectangle, about the size of a gas station. He explains this site provides understanding to a history that's otherwise difficult to track. He's learned the first Chinese immigrants in the state used this spot as a trading post, did laundry here, what kind of food was raised.
It's the seed for the Chinese communities that evolve in southwestern Wyoming that are fairly robust and long-lived.
One that expanded across southern Wyoming. But if you're unfamiliar with this history, you're not alone. Gardner explains it's because the history has been largely erased. There's no comprehensive account of Chinese heritage, history, or contributions in Wyoming, despite once being a significant portion of the local population. Primary sources seem to disappear, scholarship is spotty. Today, multiple Chinatowns in Wyoming remain underground. Many do know of the Rock Springs Massacre, where white miners killed upwards of 28 Chinese individuals. But the full history there is in doubt too. No accounts were taken from Chinese witnesses, no white miners were ever prosecuted. While 28 bodies were found, it's possible hundreds of Chinese miners were actually killed. This erasure is not unique to Wyoming, according to William Way.
They are erased from American history because of the way we construct our master narrative. That is to say, how we understand ourselves. And how we understand ourselves is essentially as a white nation.
Way is a professor of modern Chinese history at the University of Colorado Boulder. The work being erased occurred primarily in the mid-1800s, when Chinese immigrants arrived in the States seeking economic opportunity. The railroad company Union Pacific brought in men from China to work on the Transcontinental Railroad, including to here in southwest Wyoming. At one point, Rock Springs had a majority Chinese population.
It's difficult to believe today that there were Chinatowns all over the American West, as many as over 200 of them. And yet they were driven out of those. Often they were burned out, violently driven out.
Wei explains the law effectively condemned Chinese immigrants, making it difficult for them to establish a life in the U.S. Due to the Chinese Exclusion Act, they weren't allowed to become citizens. The Supreme Court decided they couldn't take the stand. Several factors also made it nearly impossible to bring wives or families to the U.S. By the 1920s, Chinese folks who lasted in Wyoming had an incentive to leave, promised a retirement stipend if they returned to China. With all that in mind, their populations were down in Wyoming, and little history was remembered, or more accurately, preserved. Most recent numbers find Wyoming's population is just 0.2% Chinese. But if things had gone differently, Wei says certainly Wyoming and the region could look different today.
If they hadn't begun excluding Chinese from the West, their numbers would have grown. They would have been able to establish families.
When a place has a racist past, Wei says that understandably makes it less welcoming to those persecuted, even generations later. But Wei says there are many strategies to repair that broken relationship. A community can apologize. It can also lift up its past.
Hi, my name's Ricky Leo.
Grace and Ricky Leo are supporters of that idea. They grew up here in Rock Springs and now live in California. Ricky's dad came to Wyoming in 1938 and served in World War II, which is how he got his citizenship. Grace arrived in the 70s from Hong Kong. Growing up in Rock Springs, Ricky and Grace say they never learned about the massacre in school or anything else on Chinese history there.
I knew nothing about anything about
Chinatown,
Chinese history. Wyoming was really wasn't taught that much.
Now, Ricky wishes there was more acknowledgement of that history and isn't sure if the memorial for the massacre is enough. There's a tan stone that sits about 6 feet high in town with a plaque listing the names of those killed. Grace agrees. More acknowledgement.
It's almost forgotten. It's kind of like a little tiny stone there.
So, from the Leo's perspective, there's work to be done.
They did make major contributions to Wyoming as railroad workers, as coal mine workers.
Restaurant workers.
I mean, it's good to learn our history and so that we don't forget about the lessons of the past.
The daily bells are ringing inside the Rock Springs Museum. Upstairs, there's a section remembering Chinese history and the massacre. Jennifer Messer, museum coordinator, says there have been artifacts and photography related to this history shown for decades.
But I don't know that it was all presented as anything more than the Chinese also lived here in this community.
In fact, telling a more complete story hasn't been an easy task. The massacre wasn't included in the local school curriculum until the year 2000, says Messer. It wasn't until 2016 that the memorial described earlier was placed in town. She says, initially, the idea for that memorial wasn't welcome.
I think there was a vocal group of people that didn't want to celebrate this, didn't want to make it a big deal. Can't you keep something very small, maybe inside the museum, and it not be a big monument someplace that we make a big to-do over?
On the other hand, Messer says Chinese tourists have been happy to see the history on display. and the museum has seen increased visitorship to the town's historic sites in the past few years. And Messer says the museum board is at the point where they want to put more of this history at the forefront.
And I've always felt really strongly that this is our actual history, and you show it in all of its naked glory.
Many agree. Individuals have taken up the cause in order to more accurately tell Wyoming's history. From students to Chinese historians to Gardner himself. In addition to this dig site, he's working to uncover two buried Chinatowns in the region. And now he's working to finish a comprehensive account of Chinese history in Wyoming.
What happened to it? Was this a purposeful disappearing of this thing? Was this a tilling of this into the ground so that we have no memory of it? And that I want to know. And it's not to be smirched or to make people feel bad about their heritage or history themselves. It's to know why, and so that we can correct that in the future and not necessarily make those same mistakes over and again.
With all of these efforts, the hope is to begin and tell a more accurate history of how Wyoming came to be what it is today. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
When we come back, we will talk about the issue of diversity in Wyoming. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Modern West.
The king of billionaire land grabbers? Well, that's John Malone. The cable tycoon owns more than 2.2 million acres of land, according to the Land Report 100.
But do we really want to put that much environmental control in one man's hands? The Environmental Billionaire, Part 4 of the Ghost Towning series. Find The Modern West under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org, sponsored by Sheridan Travel and Tourism.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming is majority white, but the state is more diverse than people think. And that's a misconception the Wyoming Community Foundation says allows for racism and racial disparities to go unchecked. The problem is explored in a report titled Does Race Matter in Wyoming? Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson sat down with the foundation's chief operating officer, Sameen Dadilahi, to learn more.
Before we get into the findings of that report, I wanted to ask you why the foundation felt like that was even a question that needed to be asked.
Thank you. I think we started asking ourselves that question because of the noticeable gap in data available in Wyoming that has been disaggregated by race and ethnicity. So every single time we tried to go and find some information, whether it was juvenile justice or health or anything like that, and we tried to look at it through a race ethnicity lens, it became incredibly difficult to get that information in any consistent way. And so we wanted to know whether or not that was a reporting issue. So we looked into actually trying to disaggregate data sets ourselves, and it became increasingly complicated. Part of it driven because of our low population density, and so there were privacy issues with some of the data that was available. And the other part of it was the fact that people just didn't think it was important to collect this information. So that was a huge driving force for us, is recognizing that if people don't think something is important, they're not going to collect information related to it. And so that made us really ask the question of, well, does race matter in Wyoming? Why do people think it doesn't, right? Of course, to us it matters, but in general, what is going on that makes people think that this is not an issue that we have to dig into?
And so what did you find out about that? Because the findings are really interesting and important, but what I'm more interested in is what you discovered about why people don't think it matters.
What we discovered is probably what you would expect, is that most people in Wyoming believe that this is a white state with a very low minority population, which is true. We do have a very low number of people of color, but it's still 15% of the population. And when you discuss that number with people, they were inordinately surprised. The number of people who believe that Wyoming is 97% white, for example, is high. Now, I don't have a survey that can prove that, but just based on anecdotal evidence from the people that we spoke with, that was definitely true. So we decided we had to take a step back and really look at do people in Wyoming actually understand that we have people of color here? And do they understand issues of equality and equity and race and ethnicity and what all of that means when you combine it together? So our goal in creating the Does Race Matter in Wyoming publication was really for it to be a basic, like a primer on race and ethnicity in Wyoming and what that should mean to people.
What were you hoping that it would do for the state?
Well, it was a baby step. So first we wanted to get the information out there so that people would have time to digest it and think about it and consider it, and also understand what racial makeup looks like for the state. Because the Wind River Reservation is so big in Wyoming, and big, I mean big in idea, big in voice, big in thought, and probably our highest area of racial tension, that is what people tend to focus on, is that our Native American population. And our Native American population, in comparison to our Hispanic Latino population, is so small. It's not the majority of the people of color that we have in Wyoming. So also trying to broaden people's horizons in terms of what they think about race in Wyoming when they are thinking about it.
And what, in your view, is the risk in not paying attention? Not just in terms of the harm that it causes people of color, but thinking for in terms of the well-being of our state. Like, if we're not tuned in to racial disparities, if we're not addressing racism, what are the consequences for all of us who live here?
Well, number one, you can't ignore 15% of your population. Right? So that's number one. If we're just discounting two people out of every 30, we're doing ourselves a disservice. And number two, I look at the suffragette movement, so the women's equality movement, and the amount of anger and just total vitriol that was expressed towards women when they were looking for more equality. And I think a lot of that has to do with this fear of power sharing, that when you are looking, when a group of people hold a certain level of power, and then they start thinking about equality and what equality means, to those people, and to many people, not trying to other those people, to many people, implicit in that is saying that for us to be more equal, I have to give something up and you're going to take something from me. And so that idea of being so scared about power sharing really underlines so many of the social justice issues that we have in the country and the state. But in the end, if you do share that power like you do with what like we have with women, you become a better place, not a worse place. Every industrial country in the world has equality for women, right? So those things, those resources like love and respect, caring and equality and freedom, those are not finite resources. You don't have a limited amount of love in your heart so that when you have one child, if you have a second, now it's going to be split because you only have this much love in a container and now they're only going to get half of each, right? If those aren't finite, we don't have to think about it that way. And if we can get Wyoming to a place where people understand that now, we won't have to fight a 50-year battle later on, because Wyoming is changing. The whole world is changing.
That was Samin Dandilahi from the Wyoming Community Foundation speaking with Tennessee Watson. For a link to Why Does Race Matter in Wyoming, you can check out the report at wyomingpublicmedia.org. When we come back, we'll discuss how COVID-19 brought some populations together in Jackson, and we'll explore an important issue you might not have thought about. This is Open Spaces.
This time on Human Nature, it's that time of year when the shadows lengthen and we bring you stories that aren't quite human or all the way natural.
I don't remember screaming, but I remember being like, oh my gosh.
This scream just penetrated me.
A most haunted theater. I'm Erin Jones. Find Human Nature under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. When the pandemic hit in early spring, nonprofits in Teton County realized that important information could be lost in translation. That's because there's a large Latino, Eastern European, and to some extent Vietnamese population in the valley. So they got together and figured out how to get their resources to immigrant communities. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska has more.
Tina Babis, who is Romanian, has lived in Jackson Hole for 10 years.
I came here as a J-1 student years ago, and then went back home and then came back here with a different visa. And yeah, here I am today.
Babis says she was lucky she met good people that helped her integrate and develop a career. But
I did meet people that were discriminated against, their nationality, and then, you know, the language barrier, accents, and all of that that comes with, you know, the fact that you're coming from a different country.
The discrimination was wide-ranging, but it also meant the foreign population were not always getting access to the necessary resources, especially as the pandemic hit. And this is what led to her accepting the position as a mobilizer with Voices JH in March. The Voices JH coordinator is Jordan Rich.
So we hired 7 mobilizers from the Latinx and Eastern European communities and began distributing messages each week to each individual mobilizer's personal networks of over 25 families each.
She says the group was founded as a solution to a problem: how to get COVID-19 resources to the immigrant community in Jackson.
We knew that marginalized communities and people of color are disproportionately affected by COVID, and they're also often the frontline workers, especially in Jackson. We were concerned that they weren't getting the public health information that they needed to stay safe. We were also concerned that they didn't have the resources for their families, considering that immigrant community members couldn't apply for unemployment or receive the federal stimulus check.
According to the 2010 U.S. Census, 15% of Teton County's population is Hispanic or Latino, and 11% is a foreign-born person. Local officials figure that it is currently over 30% of the population. So far, the initiative has been wildly successful. Rana de la Cruz, originally from Mexico, is also a mobilizer. He speaks to me in Spanish, and Rich translates.
It's
been a beautiful experience because I've learned about the needs of our community. I've been able to develop the trust with community members to share what their needs are and to see the bigger supports that are needed in our community.
It turns out these communities needed help with more than just COVID resources.
Yeah, some examples are information about COVID, camps for kids, food resources for families that need it.
De La Cruz has been living in Jackson for 21 years. He helps get messages out on social media and through texts and calls.
Because of my job, I have a lot of connections to different families in the community, and I was able to create a large network.
Coordinator Jordan Rich says that information gets spread to others from there.
We know that we are directly connecting with over 200 individuals each week, but we suspect the actual outreach is much closer to over 500 between the different social media posts and resharing that's happening within the community.
It could be argued that COVID-19 helped them access individuals who had needed services and had been missed over the years. And this is important for Tina Babis.
The immigrants are in a disadvantage because, I don't know if that's the word, you know, there is the language barrier and also the lack of education when it comes to where to look for information to help yourself when you're in need.
Voices of JH says they now see there is a real need for this kind of service in other parts of the community. So they are working to add a Vietnamese mobilizer and are working to get funding so they can continue the service for more needs than just COVID-19. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Since 1980, the U.S. has admitted more than 3 million refugees. Wyoming is the only state in the country to not participate in a refugee resettlement program, meaning that those seeking a new home cannot be directly settled in the state's borders. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with University of Wyoming Assistant Law Professor Jerry Fowler, who is also the supervisor of the UW Law School's International Human Rights Clinic, about the impact this can have on our state.
First to start, what is the definition of a refugee? What kinds of requirements do people have to meet to be classified as a refugee?
Legally, a refugee is someone who has fled their home country because of a well-founded fear of persecution based on their race or their religion or their political views or their ethnicity or their membership in a particular social group. In the U.S. system, the resettlement of refugees is the resettlement of people who are overseas who have fled their country because of this well-founded fear. And every year, the United States government sets an overall cap on refugee admissions, which for the year we're in now is 15,000. And there's a very extensive vetting process done by the federal government as to whether someone is a refugee and then whether they're otherwise qualified to come into the United States, which means they don't have a criminal background, they're not a security risk, they don't have health problems, et cetera, et cetera. And then once the decision is made by the federal government to admit them to the United States, they're resettled in particular communities. And that's spread out over the whole United States, except for Wyoming. Wyoming is actually the only state in the union that doesn't accept refugees.
But what does that mean? I know that we don't participate formally in a refugee resettlement program, but does that mean no refugees can come to Wyoming?
Well, it means they don't get resettled into Wyoming when they come directly from overseas. Now, once a refugee gets resettled, they create a life in the United States. And, you know, like anyone else who's living in the United States, they can move around. So there are definitely people in Wyoming who came to the United States originally as refugees, but they weren't formally resettled originally into Wyoming.
What is a little bit of the recent history behind this issue? You know, have nonprofit groups or lawmakers, you know, attempted to get something like this here?
A number of years ago, there were steps taken to create a refugee resettlement center in Wyoming under Governor Mead. And he originally notified the federal government that Wyoming was looking into it, and then it became controversial and basically, the effort kind of faded away.
In your opinion, what are the practical effects of Wyoming not participating in a program? You know, does it take things away from residents of this state or opportunities away from people coming to this country?
That's in some ways a difficult question to answer. Wyoming is a state with a relatively small population. And so if Wyoming accepted refugees, it wouldn't accept that many because they're spread out over the whole country. And the fact is that other states can pick up the slack of Wyoming in accepting refugees. I think the real harm, there are two harms, really. One is that, you know, welcoming refugees is a way to share the good fortune that we have as a country with people who have suffered one of the most unfortunate things you can imagine, which is being driven from their homes. And we as a country do that, but Wyoming doesn't participate in that. So Wyoming's not helping out in the way that other states are. It does kind of portray an image of Wyoming as not being a welcoming place, which I don't think is an accurate image. But if that, you know, image is portrayed, that could discourage other people from coming to Wyoming. And then the second harm, I think, is just we're depriving ourselves of the benefit of new people coming in, usually people who are very oriented towards succeeding, who have a lot of energy, who often end up in our country as a whole being very successful. And it doesn't really make sense for us as a state not to want people to come here who are looking to build a better life. I mean, that's what most of the people who came to Wyoming in the last 125 years have been coming for, and refugees are no different in that regard. And why would we not want to welcome a population, relatively small in number, but eager to succeed?
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler speaking with UW Law Professor Jerry Fowler about Wyoming's lack of participation in refugee resettlement. Public land popularity has been increasing for years, with geotagging playing a significant role. That's posting a photo on social media with the geographical information included. That trend and the subsequent crowds created a geotagging backlash. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, the conversation around geotagging is changing.
Vanessa Chavriaga loves to be outside, whether it's floating down a river in the desert or ice skating on a frozen alpine lake. And when she posts photos of her adventures, she includes information about where exactly she was.
These are public lands, right? Like, we're all supposed to have access to them. And it doesn't really make sense for us to keep public lands a secret. That, you know, that's an oxymoron. That doesn't make any sense at all.
Chavriaga is a mixed-race Colombian woman, and the way she sees it is, if she can expand another person of color's access or knowledge of the outdoors, then it's a win.
With social media and with geotagging, a person of color doesn't have to have these generations of knowledge to know where to go on a hike.
Chavriaga believes the anti-geotagging movement is just the latest form of gatekeeping and a way for white people to police others.
So when people choose not to geotag, what they're really doing is perpetuating who has access to nature, which has historically been white people.
Visitor data from agencies, including the National Park Service, does show people of color are significantly underrepresented when it comes to visiting public lands.
We're not trying to exclude people or keep people away.
That's Kate Sollett. She's white and the executive director of the Jackson Hole Travel and Tourism Board, which has taken a negative stance on geotagging. Here's one of its marketing videos.
When you're ready to share a photo of one of the many breathtaking areas of our vast wild, we ask that you skip the specific location tag. Instead, share your photo using our generic location tag. Tag responsibly, keep Jackson Hole wild.
Sollett says they came up with the campaign when they started seeing increased traffic to more fragile areas in Grand Teton National Park. She also says there was a growing number of incidents of people who were getting lost or injured when they were ill-prepared for hikes.
And the reason they were going on these hikes was because they were seeing a little pin on their phone thinking, oh, this looks like a cool area and there are a lot of people in this location, so let's go there, without really planning or doing research or speaking to locals or rangers to find out more about this destination.
Sollett says the campaign isn't meant to discourage people from visiting.
On the contrary, the more people who know and appreciate public lands, the more stewards we have for protecting them. But we want people to be more mindful, have a more intentional, meaningful experience with the places they visit.
Still, other conservation groups have walked back similar anti-geotagging campaigns. For instance, in September, the nonprofit Leave No Trace reconsidered its social media guidelines. Dana Watts is white and the organization's executive director.
The biggest change more recently was with our more clear guidance on we're not anti-geotagging, and there is a reason for that, and we don't this idea of gatekeeping.
Instead, when posting a geotag, they encourage users to include educational information like safety measures, what to expect when visiting, or the location's history and culture. But for Vanessa Chavriaga, the entire controversy around geotagging is really about something more fundamental.
Our conceptions of what nature is and what wilderness is primarily come from myths that have been created by, to be frank, white colonizers that invaded this land several hundred years ago.
She says she was glad to see Leave No Trace walk their geotagging guidelines back. In the meantime, Chavriaga and groups like Outdoor Afro, Latino Outdoors, and other recreational groups for non-white communities are working to make it easier for people of color to get out on our public lands. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Coming up, we'll experience the journey of what it's like to get basic cultural amenities when Wyoming doesn't offer one, and UW tries to become more diverse. This is Open Spaces.
This time on the Kids Ask Why podcast, 8-year-old David learns about all the wildlife that live on Heart Mountain near Cody.
There is a bear den. The last we knew about it, there was a black bear that was utilizing it for a den.
While 8-year-old Charlotte finds out how these bears are managed.
Other times we trap bears as a research just to get some information on them.
Find Kids Ask Why under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Getting a haircut, shopping for groceries, or celebrating holidays can be difficult for people of color and immigrants living in Wyoming. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao takes us on a journey to find her comfort foods.
It's a beautiful, bright Saturday, which means that the 2.5-hour trip from Laramie to Denver will be pretty smooth. I'm driving down there to get the foods I usually eat as part of my diet. I'm from Indonesia. My comfort foods aren't available in Wyoming, and I cannot eat pasta and burgers on a regular basis anymore. After getting gas, I hit the road.
So we are like 41 minutes away from Lotus Asian Market.
Lotus Asian Market in Aurora, Colorado, is always the first place I visit. It's smaller and a good place to get snacks and little treats. It's not the main place I go to, though.
Corporate special interests in the front row. John Deacon.
Hi. I got what I needed. I pick up curly shrimp crackers, fried tempeh or soybeans, and chilled jasmine tea. Then I hit the road to my next stop, Pacific Ocean Marketplace. That's where I get my main ingredients, like spices, meat, appetizers, and many more, depending on what's available. When I arrive, I forget how huge this place is. Pacific Ocean Marketplace is pretty much an Asian market, but they specialize in groceries for people from around the world. There's Indian food, Korean, Chinese, or even Jamaican, and many more, including Indonesian cuisine, which is what I'm here for. Pacific Ocean Marketplace, or known as POM, has 3 locations in the Denver area. That's how big they are. It's a Southeast Asian family-owned business, and they've been open for more than 20 years.
And they have instant bubble tea. This is amazing. Instant.
I usually spend hours here, because I get foods for 1 to 2 months worth of meals, not just for dinner.
Here it is. Here's the Indonesian aisle. One small section. Better than nothing.
I got all my favorites. Sweet soy sauce, somai, which is dumplings but softer and more circular in shape. I got the necessary spices to make traditional Indonesian meals I grew up with, like ayam balado, which is chicken mixed with different types of peppers and chili, and yellow rice with boiled eggs and fried onions, which is called nasi kuning. And of course, I could not leave with my all-time favorite snack that you can find anywhere in Indonesia, fried bananas. But what I love the most about these trips is running into people who speak my native language, or is from my country.
Dari Indonesia, ya?
Yeah.
Oh my God. Padahal ada feeling ini kayaknya dari apa?
I heard them speak Bahasa Indonesia, which is the language spoken in the country, and asked them where they're from in the archipelago. They excitedly share their background and how they got to the Mountain West. I did the same.
Oh, kayak mama juga dari Surabaya. Gimana, oh, ya? Surabaya?
Kamu dari mana?
Jakarta. Dari Jakarta, ya. Surabaya-nya di mana?
As much as I wanted to speak with them longer, it was getting late and I had a long drive ahead of me. We exchanged phone numbers and went our separate ways. I checked out and went to my car. As I drive back up to Wyoming, I think of whether this sacrifice is worth it or not. Driving 5 hours to purchase the things that sustain my lifestyle. It reminds me of the American dream, to come to America and achieve your goals and dreams, but it didn't include the American reality of the sacrifice and compromise one has to make to achieve it. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Naina Rao.
Part of the University of Wyoming's mission is to value and nurture diversity, but that's hard to do when the university struggles to attract and retain faculty and administrators of color. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson has more.
Dr. Emily Monago has been the University of Wyoming's Chief Diversity Officer for over 3 years.
I couldn't have made a better decision or a better choice.
She loves her work and the perks of living in Laramie.
I have a wonderful view of snow-capped mountains. It's just beautiful.
But when the job announcement went out, she almost let it pass her by.
So it was a colleague of mine, and she said, "Have you read this job announcement at the University of Wyoming? It sounds like everything you've been talking about." And I was like, "I saw it, but I didn't read it."
Monago didn't read it because as a Black woman living in a diverse part of Ohio, it was hard for her to imagine moving to Wyoming.
It's just like, how does life work there when I'm not going to see many people who look like me or find the things that I'm used to finding easily?
In her role as Chief Diversity Officer, Monago has heard countless concerns from people of color considering jobs at UW. It's hard to move to a new place and realize the pharmacy doesn't carry makeup for your skin tone in its beauty aisle, or there's no one who can cut and style your hair.
It doesn't feel very welcoming and is not on the radar of a lot of people.
But when Monago arrived in 2017, her job as Chief Diversity Officer was to change that and to get inclusivity on UW's radar. Study after study have shown that diversity leads to more creative and innovative thinking. McKinsey & Company's 2015 study of more than 1,000 companies in 15 countries found that businesses with more diverse leadership were more likely to have above-average profits. Diversity was included in UW's strategic plan with innovation in mind. And Monago adds, because it benefits all students, including those who are white.
Our students are going to work all over the world, and they are going to engage with people outside of the state of Wyoming. And so it's very important that we provide those opportunities for cultural competence to develop that.
But UW still has a lot of work to do.
We're lagging behind our student diversity when it comes to employees at the university.
Monago says 13% of students are underrepresented racial minorities, but only 10% of employees are. UW professor Jacqueline Bridgman says Wyoming's reputation doesn't help.
A lot of folks equate us with places in the South and white supremacist places. And then you throw in the Matthew Shepard incident on top of that.
Bridgman directs UW's School of Culture, Gender, and Social Justice and serves on a campus committee to improve recruitment and retention of faculty of color. She's Black and grew up in Laramie.
We're actually more diverse than we were when I grew up as a kid, right? It's actually changed quite a bit.
But racism prevails. And Bridgman says unless Wyoming deals with that, it will continue to drive talented people away.
It's a huge issue. You know, we lost one of our really good faculty members. He moved to New York. He loved it at the university. He felt included. It was great. He loved his job. He had lots of good friends. His kids were getting bullied at Laramie High School.
Bridgman says her colleague moved to protect his family. This is just one example of many told to Wyoming Public Radio. And a 2019 campus climate survey revealed that 17% of respondents had considered leaving because their children or a member of their household had not felt welcomed or included in the local community. Dr. Monago says her office is also working to address racism off campus. She says a community engagement committee has done things like partner with local schools to address bullying. But change takes time. Minago says that's why UW needs to be upfront with new hires about the challenges they're likely to face.
We don't want to sell something that doesn't exist. So we thought it was very important to put together our own type of onboarding and welcoming packet. It's for all employees, but it has information in there specifically for communities of color.
The packet includes the location of the closest African and Asian markets in Colorado and suggestions for Black barbershops and where to get braids. And
there also had to be that honesty there that you will run into people who haven't been around much diversity and maybe don't care to be around much diversity.
Given that reality, Dr. Minago says ongoing support is critical. Last fall, UW launched several employee networks. Christy Carter coordinates the effort.
The employee networks create that environment for people to come together, talk about issues, for social gatherings, community building, professional development, and mentoring.
There are currently 6 networks for African American and Black employees, Asian American and Pacific Islanders, Native American and Indigenous people, LGBTQ+, Latinx, as well as a women's group. And Carter says a network for people with disabilities is starting up.
It created that place where it was safe. It's okay. It's okay to share your frustration, and you are not alone.
Jacqueline Bridgman, who grew up in Wyoming, says that sense of support and inclusion needs to extend beyond UW's campus.
Especially in a place like Wyoming, I think it's going to have to almost be a statewide effort. Right. It's easier for us to recruit at the university if the rest of Wyoming is inclusive and supportive.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. Our stories and the entire show can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You can also find individual segments on social media and never miss an episode by getting this program via podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. As I mentioned, we are trying to step up our coverage about race, and we'd love to hear any story ideas on that topic or any other. You can submit those via our website as well. We'd also love it if you'd support our news coverage with your pledge. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.